Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Mayanthi Fernando, the author of The Republic Unsettled, Muslim French and the Contradictions of Secularism. And the book was published by Duke University Press in 2014. Hi there, Mayanthi.
Hi, Roxane.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Sure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Could you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Sure. Well, I am an anthropologist, and I have been working on France since about 1999, 2000. My interest in France and sort of the topic of Islam in France took a sort of circuitous route. I was initially interested more in England and the question of British Muslims, mostly of Pakistani, Indian, and Bangladeshi descent. But when I was in graduate school, I ended up shifting my focus to France for a couple of reasons. I had a professor of mine, Michel-Rolf Trouillot, who pointed out that that many anthropologists of color end up working sort of on themselves, so to speak, when they don't, you know, when they end up doing their PhD projects. And I myself am of South Asian descent, and that was partly why I had been initially interested in the question of South Asian British Muslims in the first place. I've spent time in England. I've lived in England. And he sort of pointed out that part of the process of decolonizing anthropology was for anthropologists of color to work on the West and on topics that were not necessarily connected in some personal way. And so, that was a really influential and sort of significant point that he made for me. And I started to rethink the place that I was going to work on. I have no sort of personal connection to France, just as most white anthropologists have no personal connection to the places that they work on. And so in some ways, it was a bit of a political decision to work on a place that I really had no, you know, kind of integral connection to. And that's really how the project in some ways came about. I had done my BA thesis on British Muslims in Bradford, England. And I had originally, you know, thought about kind of continuing that project in graduate school. But I ended up turning my focus to France. And I'm very glad I did. I mean, it's become a really interesting place for, you know, obvious reasons. And when I initially started my research, it was, you know, as I said, in 1999, and it was before the 2004 law banning headscarves in public schools. It was obviously after the 1989, you know, first initial so-called headscarf crisis. Mm-hmm. But I started my research during a period of time where it seemed like there was a period of a kind of détente between the French state and its Muslim community. And then when I went to the field, everything sort of blew up. I was there between 2002 and 2004. And that's, you know, that was sort of the beginning of this new process of conflict and consternation around the question of Muslims, or what's being called the Muslim question.
So Mayanthi, the book is called The Republic Unsettled, or at least that's the first part of the title. Could you say a little bit more about that choice of the word unsettled and what you refer to early on in the book as this trope of disruption?
Sure. The title came to me pretty late, and I'm obviously playing on the question of settler colonialism and the sort of history of Algeria in France. And as you said, part of what I was trying to do was get at the way in which the Republic seems deeply unsettled by its population of Muslim citizens. And I'm playing with unsettled in a couple of ways. One, as I just said, you know, trying to think about the history and the haunting of colonialism in Algeria and Morocco and Tunisia and in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. But I'm also trying to get at the way in which Muslim French really disrupt some of the taken for granted assumptions and norms of the Republic, and unsettle many of the sense of France, I think, that so many non-Muslim majoritarian French take for granted. And that's what I was trying to do with the title.
I have to ask you, maybe before we talk about the rest of the title, about the cover of the book. It's, I don't ask everybody about this, but I was really struck by the cover of the book when it arrived. And can you say a little bit about how that, about the image?
Well, the image is called Infinity Sound. It's a sculpture in white resin by a Italian, Muslim Italian artist named Patricia Maimuna Guresi. Mm-hmm. And the image is basically of a Sufi in prayer. And it's part of the reason that I chose it was because it's incredibly androgynous. Mm-hmm. It's not clear if it's a man or a woman. We're so used to thinking about, if you've noticed, you know, many of the books on Islam in France, and particularly on gender in Islam in France, often have a woman in a headscarf, mm-hmm. And often a woman in a red, white, and blue headscarf, right? I mean, this is a kind of classic image, and this is not a critique of these books. I think that a lot of, it's the image that immediately comes to mind. Sure. And I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something that would actually also, to go back to the title, that would unsettle the readership's understanding of what this book was about. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to do the kind of conventional representation that so many books about Islam in France do. And so I thought a lot about what the title would be, and I actually ended up sort of going back and forth with Duke University Press. They wanted initially something more classic and kind of almost neo-orientalist, and I really held the line pretty firmly that I didn't want to do that. And what I like about the image is that it is a Muslim. I mean, it is a representation of a Muslim person. But that is not immediately obvious. And if you mm-hmm. don't know what it is, you don't know what the image is about. I also liked that it invoked in some way, people have said that it reminds them of The Scream. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of playing with the multiple possible interpretations of the cover. So it could also be, a European or French person basically screaming at, mm-hmm. at the sense of unsettlement that is, you know, that is caused by the presence of Muslim French. And so I wanted a cover that didn't immediately say, this is a book about Islam or this is a book about Islam in France. Mm-hmm. And I hope that that's what the cover did. I mean, I'm curious about what you made of it.
I mean, I thought about Masquerade and theater. Was my mm-hmm. first response to it, I think, because the image reminds me of maybe some images I've seen of theater masks and some yeah. of that kind of thing. So one of the things that I like about having these conversations with authors is you get to hear a little bit more about those negotiations with presses and those kinds of decisions that we don't always get to find out about right. when we're reading a book. I want to ask you now about the second part of the title, and in particular, your use of Muslim French.
Yeah, well, Muslim French was a kind of neologism that I came up with fairly early on in the project. And it's a translation of the term citoyen français de confession musulmane, mm. which French citizen of Muslim faith. And it's part of the reason I translated that into Muslim French was because it's such a long sure. phrase, right? Of French citizens of Muslim or Muslim citizen. I'm sorry, French citizens of Muslim faith, which is how a lot of my interlocutors refer to themselves. So if I said to them, you know, can you sort of describe how you would describe yourself? Like, what would you call yourself? They would say, je suis citoyenne française de confession musulmane. And I chose Muslim French because it doesn't roll easily off the tongue. It does for me now because I've used it so much. Mm-hmm. And so I've sort of forgotten that initially it didn't quite work. The term that you'll probably see that most people use is French Muslims. And the reason that I didn't use French Muslims was because French Muslims seems, so in the term French Muslims, French is the adjective that describes Muslim, but the kind of, the identity, the noun, the nominal identity is Muslim. Mm-hmm. And so French is a matter of happenstance in some ways. And the vast majority of my interlocutors understood themselves as profoundly French and also profoundly Muslim. And part of the difficulty, and this is what I was trying to get at with the term Muslim French itself, part of the difficulty is that, you know, grammar in some ways forces you to choose one identity or another. And so one is your you know, noun identity, and the other is the adjective that describes the noun. Mm-hmm. And the identity that I was trying to describe, the identity that's inhabited by my Muslim French interlocutors, is one in which being Muslim and being French are one is as important as the other, and one is as foundational as the other. And so Muslim French in some ways was a way for me to both describe that, but also give a sense of how difficult it is to inhabit that identity, not because the inhabitation of that identity in itself is difficult, but because the rest of the world, the rest of France, non-Muslim French, seem to have a lot of difficulty accepting that as a possibility even of being Muslim French. So that was what I was trying to invoke with the kind of difficulty of the title itself. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it worked, but I that was the goal.
Well, it certainly worked for me as a reader. As soon as I saw the title, it's not that I disliked it. I just noticed it to be a different way of referring. And it made me think about, okay, why didn't she use French Muslims? Of course, once I started to read the book, I came to understand that because you explained it in the book, but I did notice it right away. So,
And that was success. The point. Yes. Right. I wanted people to think like, wait, that doesn't really make any sense. What does that mean?
Right.
So that was precisely what I was trying to get at and trying to go for.
Well, I want to come back to the rest of the title and to this idea of secularism in a moment, but you've talked about your interlocutors a couple of times and we'll be continuing to talk about them, but I wanted to just ask a few kind of broad questions about your work as an anthropologist and, you know, that the book is based on this field work that you completed in France over a number of years. Mm-hmm. And that included a number of interviews. So I just wanted to ask some questions about, you know, the process and your method. You know, when and where did you conduct this field work? What made you choose the sites that you did? Who did you interview? What can you tell us about selecting your interlocutors?
Sure. I went to France for about 2 years of field work, from September 2002 to September 2004, with about 5 years between 2006 and 2011, 5 years of kind of additional field work during the summers or during, mm-hmm. you know, a week or 2 weeks here and there. The vast majority of my Muslim interlocutors were, as I said, people who thought of themselves as committed to being French citizens. And so the method I used was a sort of snowball method, right? You meet one person who introduces you to colleagues and friends, and through that you meet a bunch of other people. But I also largely focused on activists in civil and civic associations, like the Muslim Students of France or the Young Muslims of France or the Union of Islamic Organizations of France. There are these various local and national level organizations that, as you probably know, I mean, the associational life is a huge part of being French, right? Of being sort of a citizen, and Muslims are no different from a lot of other French people who participate in these local and regional and national associations. They create associations, they participate in them. So there's a huge amount of associational activity that's associated with the Islamic revival in France. And so that was largely the sites of my field work when I was there between 2002 and 2004. And that was in terms of my Muslim interlocutors, that was largely the set of interlocutors that I had. But then I also worked with a number of bureaucrats in the, you know, in the French state, basically. So a lot of people within the Bureau of Religions, that's part of the Ministry of the Interior. And then for both of the years of my field work between 2002 and 2004, I worked as a language assistant in a lycée in La Courneuve. And so a number of my interlocutors were also public school teachers who were also my colleagues. And mm-hmm. so I'm trying to think if there were other important interlocutors. you know, some, a certain number of French intellectuals as well, but largely Muslim civic activists, bureaucrats from the Ministry of the Interior and French public school teachers were my interlocutors. And then because I was working in a school, I had a chance to do kind of classic, you know, participant observation in these spaces and see the sort of interactions between teachers around the question of Muslim students, between Muslim students and teachers, just the kind of consternation that was generated by, you know, girls in headscarves or you know, Muslim students like circulating the Quran or things like that. I was there in the teacher's room when, you know, the 2004 law was proposed, and then when the Stasi Commission proposed the law proposed a law in December 2003. And so it was a really interesting time to be there because I was there on, you know, in person for a lot of these conversations. It wasn't just reading about it in the newspaper. I was actually there and talking to people and participating. I ended up participating in a kind of collective that mobilized against the proposed law in 2003. And so part of my research, and I talk about this in the book, you know, part of my research was actually participating with a lot of my interlocutors in some of these civic associations, not necessarily the Muslim civic associations, but certainly the kind of progressive collectives that formed on questions of, you know, to combat Islamophobia, to these sort of anti-racist, anti-Islamophobia, anti-veil law associations, a feminist association that incorporated a number of practicing Muslims, non-practicing Muslims, secular French feminists, I mean, a large and diverse group of feminists, basically. So a lot of my field work was not just interviews, but rather also actually being there and kind of being part of a certain movement in some ways.
Could you tell us, Mayanthi, a little bit more about the way the book is organized? And I'm in particular thinking about the insertion of these, is it three moments of field notes in between? I think it follows the first two chapters and then, you know, the next two. And so I'm curious about that, just in terms of how you thought about the structure of the book and the overall plan here.
Yeah. So the book is structured, it begins with an introduction, and then it goes into, it's basically organized into three sets of two chapters. And so there's field notes and then two chapters and then another set of field notes, two chapters, and a final set of field notes with two more chapters and then an epilogue. And the way that it's organized is largely around, so the first two chapters are focused on questions of French republicanism, Republican citizenship, and Muslim French activism, and what it means to be Muslim French within the confines of Republican citizenship. The second set of chapters, so chapters 3 and 4, are mostly about French secularism and the regulation of French Muslims by the French state and the kind of contradictions that are generated by this mode of regulation, hence the second part of the title on the contradictions of secularism. Mm-hmm. And that's largely what the second set of chapters 3 and 4 are about. And then the final set, chapters 5 and 6, take up the question of republicanism, secularism, and gender sexuality. So there's one chapter about, this is chapter 5, about the emergence of the so-called secular Muslim woman and the way in which secular Muslim women become so key to propagating a sense of French secularism. And then the final chapter, chapter 6, is on the question of so-called Muslim homophobia and what I'm calling the asymmetries of tolerance. So the way in which the discourse of tolerance and respect de l'autre circulates in and interpolates Muslims in really asymmetrical ways. So that's the organization of the book. And the field notes that begin each of these sets of chapters were an attempt to just lay out in some fairly close ethnographic detail just some of the There's stories that are supposed to, in some ways, set up the chapters to follow. Mm-hmm. So they are, they're not, you know, they're not theorized. They're not really analyzed. I just kind of try to tell a pretty straightforward, or tell in a pretty straightforward way, a story that then the two chapters that follow unpack in some way.
In the introduction to the book, Mayantha, you describe the project here as an anthropological account of contemporary France that, I'm kind of quoting you and inserting some of my own words here, takes a particular approach to history. So, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm a historian that I'm doing this, but I'm curious about this because you do cover, well, a few decades, and you are also reaching back to the colonial past and thinking about the relationship between issues in contemporary France and France's historic relationship to a much broader community of Muslims. So what can you say about that, how you're working anthropologically, but also historically in the book?
Well, I as you probably noticed, many of my interlocutors are actually French historians or historians of France, right? Historians of the Third Republic and after. And what I was, as an anthropologist, have always been pretty attuned to history and to historiography and trying to think about the conditions of possibility of the present. And so my approach to history is in this book is one in which I try to account for both the continuities and discontinuities between trying to think about the traditions of French secularism and French republicanism as having a kind of, as having a history, right? So, but also as evolving constantly, and yet the kind of logics and the kind of attendant contradictions that are thrown up by the presence of Muslim French are logics and contradictions that have perdured for a long time. They just are instantiated differently with this particular community in this particular age. And so, I was really influenced, for example, by, you know, the work of Joan Scott, and her book, Only Paradoxes to Offer, where she talks about the way in which a lot of the kind of paradoxes and contradictions of French feminism in its various iterations over the course of 200 years, in a lot of ways, repeat much more integral contradictions that are foundational to the logic of republicanism itself and its difficulty in thinking through the question of difference and universalism. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking in similar ways about the kind of contradictions of secularism and of republicanism that the question of Islam kind of precipitates. And my point in a lot of ways is not that there is some kind of foundational conflict between French secularism and French republicanism and Islam, that Islam, you know, is somehow doing something radically different to republicanism, secularism, but rather that the kind of contradictions that have always existed within republicanism and secularism get precipitated by the Muslim question and by the presence of Muslims in France. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying, I don't want to say, you know, it's all exactly the same since Algeria. But I also want to attend to the way that that some of the issues and some of the conflicts and some of the consternation of the present, you know, has a historical echo.
So in the first chapter, Mayantha, you are working with these ideas of racial and religious visibility and invisibility to come at this idea of the so-called incommensurability of Muslim and French. So could you tell us more about how you do that in the first chapter of the book and maybe give us an example or two of how that's working?
Sure. I mean, the first chapter is really about the way in which it's so difficult for Muslim French to be understood as Muslim French. And so the way that when, you know, if one says I'm Muslim, it's understood as somehow trumping one's identity as French. And the people that I worked with just simply don't see themselves in that way. And one of the things I tried to I think in that chapter, in that first chapter, I talk about the way in which Muslims are interpolated as, when they are interpolated as Muslims, in the kind of majoritarian French imagination, to be Muslim is to be communalist, to be, you know, perhaps a fundamentalist, especially one, if one is publicly and visibly Muslim, right? And therefore to be not French. And there's a way in which French discourse and, state practices construct public Muslimness as being antithetical to being French. And so how does one, as a Muslim French, inhabit that identity when the very term, when the very notion of Muslim French functions in some ways as an oxymoron? And so one of the examples I give is of sitting with a friend of mine in a cafe, and we were just, you know, having lunch, and the server comes over and he looks at her and he says, "You're Muslim." And she's someone who wears a headscarf. So he comes over and he says, "You're Muslim." And she just sort of looks at him and says, "Yes." And then he laughs and he walks away. And this is a close friend of mine, so I spent a lot of time with her. And there had been other instances where she, you know, we were walking in the streets of Paris, and this old white French lady kind of came up to her and said very kindly, and this was during the NATO bombing of Afghanistan. So this old woman comes up and says to her, "You know, don't worry, you'll soon be liberated," right? As if, I mean, it just was such a crazy moment. But then there was another moment where this drunken white French man, you know, yells at her. I think he yells, you know, "Go back home, you know, sad pute," right? And, "Go back home, you dirty whore." And there are constantly moments like this in her life where she is interpolated as a Muslim, right? So you're a Muslim, as the server says. And she says yes, because she understands herself as Muslim, but she's not the Muslim. Her understanding of her Muslimness is not the understanding of Muslimness that is ascribed to her by others. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of constant misrecognition, the Muslim that she is not the Muslim that she is recognized to be. And so that's the sense of this paradoxical identity, this kind of oxymoronic identity of Muslim French that these people have to inhabit every day. And it's the oxymoron of Muslim French is not produced by they themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But by the outside world. And yet this is an identity that is important to them and that they want to inhabit. And so that first chapter is an attempt to really unpack how they do that and the kind of difficulty in inhabiting an identity whose very existence is an oxymoron in the eyes of most of the people that they have to interact with.
Mayanthi, what role do the terms or ideas or categories, you know, of immigrant and, well, I guess the ways that Islam and Muslims in France are racialized, like how does that play a role in this discussion of visibility and invisibility in the book?
Well, Muslim French are often thought about in terms of immigration. So immigration, Islam, fundamentalism. And when I say fundamentalism, it always has quotation marks around it. Mm-hmm. One of the things actually I was trying to do in the book was to get away from the framework of immigration and think about Muslim French through this framework of citizenship. Mm-hmm. There's a long history of French sociology that has consistently treated the question of Islam in France as a question of immigration and integration. And this idea of, you know, are Muslims integrated? If not, how can they be? Really pervades both public discourse about Muslims, but also a lot of French sociology until very recently. And you know, I think it's a really problematic framework because the fact is that these are people who have been born and raised in France. Sometimes their parents have been born and raised in France. And the question of immigration and integration is reinscribes their foreignness. And one of the things that I was trying to do in the book was really try to get away from this idea that they were somehow foreign and that that this was a question of immigration and integration. Because it's just not how they think of themselves. And, you know, this idea, I mean, I am sick of hearing about integration But they are really sick of hearing about the question of integration, right? Like, why aren't you integrated? Are you integrated? Oh, look, you know, he or she is so integrated. And it's just this kind of endless discourse of immigration integration that continually reinscribes them as somehow not yet or not quite French. And so I really wanted to start from the premise that they are French and see what kind of questions then followed. And so if you start from the point that they're French, then it becomes a question of, well, what kind of citizenship do they practice? What are their attitudes towards, you know, Frenchness and being a citizen? Rather than, are they integrated, right? How are they integrated? Should they be integrated? Should they be more integrated? Those sorts of questions. So I would say that the framing of immigration is a really heavy presence in a kind of public political discourse about Islam, and even a kind of academic sociological one, except for a new generation, I would say, of French sociologists who think very differently about Islam. But for my interlocutors themselves, the question of immigration was really not that important. I mean, they were obviously, you know, conscious of the role that their parents and sometimes grandparents played in rebuilding France in the period after World War II and, you know, coming as migrant laborers and reconstructing the country. But for them, that was a sign of their ensconcement in France rather than as a sign of their foreignness.
And the issue of race, how are you dealing with that in the book?
Well, the issue of race, I have to say, I don't get into the question of race perhaps as much as I should. And there has been a lot of literature in recent years about the racialization of Muslims. Part of what I'm getting at is, of course, the way in which the hypervisibility of Muslims has a lot to do with the fact that they're a racialized community. But part of what I'm trying to also get at is the nexus of race and religion in the figure of the Muslim. And this is what I meant when I was talking earlier about continuities and discontinuities. I think it's significant that the population that now goes under the sign Muslim, which doesn't necessarily mean, you know, practicing or even believing Muslim. It really means kind of Arab, you know, Arab, basically. I mean, the Muslim has become a racial marker in a lot of ways. But I would say it's become again a racial marker because in colonial Algeria, the terms musulman, indigène, Arab were largely interchangeable. The alterity of the indigenous Algerian Arab hinged largely on his and her Muslimness. And just as the alterity of the Muslim in France, I mean, the kind of the figure in the French imagination when you say Muslim is usually an Arab. And so one of the things I try to do in the book is not say there has been a racialization of Muslims, because Muslims have always been a racialized minority, a racialized community in the French imagination.
In the second chapter of the book, Mayanthi, you explore this question, can one be publicly Muslim without being classified as different? So I'm just wondering if you could say more about how you get at that question and what your interlocutors offered you in response to.
Well, when I first came to the field, I really thought that the Islamic revival should be interpreted through a framework of the right to difference and the kind of minority politics of recognition, which is largely how a lot of minoritarian movements and, you know, minoritarian so-called identity movements have been interpreted using Charles Taylor's really seminal book, The Politics of Recognition. And a lot of the claims to the right to practice Islam publicly and visibly have been understood both by politicians and scholars as a right to difference, and both in France itself, but also from outsiders in the Anglo-American world, right? So the public practice of Islam has often been understood as a claim to the right to be different. And when I got to the field, one of my interlocutors, you know, pretty early on said, we don't want the right to difference. We want the right to indifference. We want the right to be forgotten. And I, it really stuck with me. And another one of my interlocutors said, you know, what we really want is just the right to be banal, right? On veut le droit d'être banal. We want the right to be ordinary. And so I began to realize that the very framing of the public practice of Islam as a claim to the right to difference really misrepresented and misunderstood what was going on and continued to define Islam and Muslims as a sign of difference from France, right? And so what I really in that second chapter try to think about what it would mean to take seriously the demand for the right to indifference and what it would mean to think about the public practice of Islam not as a right to difference, but actually as a right to citizenship, as a right to be like any other French person in the French public sphere, where one's Muslimness was neither made invisible, right? Neither rendered invisible, but also not rendered hypervisible, which is, I think, what a discourse of a right to difference ends up doing. And so my interlocutors want to wear the headscarf, want to be able to pray five times a day, want to fast at Ramadan, want, you know, the kind of the signs of a public Muslimness without necessarily being relegated once again to a form of difference from France.
You go on in the book, Mayanthi, to talk about state attempts to make Islam a proper, and I'm doing quotes now, religion segregated from politics and culture. So can you give some examples of how the state has gone about attempting to do that and what some of the results have been?
Sure. One of the sites of fieldwork, and this was after my dissertation fieldwork, this was done in 2010 and 2011, is this very interesting place called the Institute for the Cultures of Islam, which was put in place by the Paris municipality, by the socialists and the Green Party. And it's a place in which it's understood as a way of recognizing and respecting the city's Muslim population and Muslim presence. And so it's a real gesture of inclusion. It's a way of making Islam valuable. But it's also interesting and sort of problematic because in order to make Islam valuable and recognized, the state is sort of undertaking a project of transformation, I would argue, one in which Islam has to be remade into a proper religion, and a proper religion here, and when I say proper religion, a proper religion within the terms of French secularism and secularism more broadly, one in which religion is consigned and confined to very specific places and practices that are not necessarily only private, but certainly not public, not sort of in the public sphere. And the history of the ICI, the Institute for the Cultures of Islam, there was a time in which there are these two small neighborhood mosques in the 18th arrondissement, which is where the ICI is located. And there's a lot of overflow on Fridays. And so you had Muslim men praying in the streets, which was understood as both a public order problem, but also an affront to French secularism because they were praying in public, basically. And so the ICI was constructed, and the ICI architecturally, it's such an interesting case because it architecturally disaggregates Islam into culture and religion. And so religion is confined to prayer halls within the space of the ICI. And then the rest of the ICI, which surrounds these prayer halls, is the space of Islamic culture. So there's a way in which Islam is recognized and given a place, but it's done in such a way that forces a kind of transformation of the Islamic tradition in which, you know, Islam is kind of split into religion, which is either private, right, so you practice at home, or in designated spaces of religion, i.e. the mosque or the prayer hall, and then the rest is culture.
Mm-hmm. The title of the third chapter of the book, Mayanthi, is Memorial to the Future. And, well, you could say something about that specific title, but I I wanted to use it, I guess, as an excuse to ask you about the future more broadly in the book, that, you know, yes, there is this project to consider the present in a broader context that includes a broader French history, but the future also figures importantly in the book for your interlocutors. And I'm just wondering what the future is for the different people that you were speaking with and working with in the book.
Yeah, that's a great question. If I could just go back quickly to that third chapter, just to sort of get at the what I'm calling the contradictions of secularism, the ICI, I think, is a great example of what I'm getting at, which is that that secularism ostensibly entails the division or the restriction of religion to the space of the private, right, and the kind of separation of religion and politics. Mm-hmm. But in order to enact that kind of separation, in order to secularize Islam and make it a proper religion, the state has to involve itself in the regulation of religious affairs and in that process of separation. And so there's a kind of built-in contradiction to the secular state, because it's precisely this, in the French case, the state is trying to make Islam an acceptable religion in France. But to do so, it has to involve itself in the affairs of Muslims, and it has to kind of adjudicate what is proper religion and what is culture, you know, what is politics, what is religion. And it's constantly in this mode, a kind of theological mode of adjudication about what is the is the realm of religion and what is not, right? So even this idea that the headscarf, you know, is a religious sign. I mean, the law banning headscarves is a law that bans religious signs. Well, many Muslims understand the headscarf as a practice, not a sign. So the state's adjudication of what the headscarf is here is in some ways a theological act, right? It's saying it's a sign. It's a sign of religion. Mm-hmm. And so part of the argument here, and this is where I draw on a number of theorists of the secular, you know, secularism is understood as the separation of religion and politics. But I think what we need to really think about is how secularism is not so much the separation of, but rather the regulation of and administration of religion by the political, by the state. And therein is the kind of inbuilt contradiction, because regulation obviously entails involvement, right, and administration. And so secularism can never, in fact, be about separation, but rather always about the imbrication of the religious and the political. So that's really the kind of argument that underpins chapter three, and the ICI in many ways is a way of unpacking this broader contradiction. As you said, the chapter is called A Memorial to the Future. And part of that, in some ways, is it was a phrase that was used by another interlocutor who was really confused by the project of the ICI. And he basically said, yeah, it's a memorial to the future, in the sense that they want to create, you know, they want to create Muslims of the, or they, what they want to do in some ways is, it's ostensibly a form of recognition of Muslims, but it's also a disappearance of Muslims of the present in order to create a kind of future set of Muslims who won't really be Muslim. And therefore it's in some ways, it's a memorial to us of the present. Right. So that, so that's partly what I was getting at with this memorial to the future. I mean, it's both about the future, but also in some ways it's a memorial. In terms of the actual future, which is, I think, what you were asking, you know, I don't really know. I mean, I don't really know what the future holds. I think it's particularly fraught right now, you know, in the wake of the attacks on the Charlie Hebdo offices and the kosher supermarket, and then the attacks of November 13th. I think it's a pretty perilous time in France, not just around the question of Muslims and Islam, but rather the, you know, real, like, radical reinstatement of executive authority and state power, and in the wake of November 13th, which I think is deeply troubling, certainly to me, but also to a lot of my, you know, friends and interlocutors in France. So I don't know what the future holds. For many of my interlocutors, there's a sense of a kind of missed opportunity. In some ways, right, this question that drives so much of the political and scholarly discourse in France about you know, are Muslims integrated? The people that I'm talking about, Muslim French, are about as French as one can get. And yet they were not recognized as being so. And so, you know, what happens when you're consistently not acknowledged as who you are, right? When your commitment to the Republic and your commitment is to France is just never recognized.
Your fourth chapter, Mayanthi, focuses on the 2004 ban on headscarves, and we've talked about it already a little bit. But this chapter is really focused on ideas about autonomy and authority mm-hmm. in relationship to a notion of secular citizenship. So could you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. The question of autonomy and authority came up partly because I was trying to understand the kind of subjectivity of the women who were my interlocutors who wore the veil. And some of them didn't actually wear the veil, but had a similar understanding of the relationship between interiority and exteriority, where external practices were thought to actually construct internal desire and internal will in some ways. And what I was trying to get at was the way in which for these Muslim French women, autonomy and authority were not understood as oppositional, but rather worked together to produce the proper Muslim self. So it was precisely by submitting to certain forms of normative Islamic authority that one came to be the authentic Muslim that one always was, and that one came to find one's autonomy as a subject, right? Autonomy from fellow humans rather than from God or normative authority. And what was curious to me was in some ways how this mapped on to a fairly Republican understanding of the self, in which, you know, the French subject citizen emerges precisely through the authority of the French, I mean, certainly the school system, right? And if in, I went back and I read, you know, Durkheim on moral education, and it was such an interesting read because it was, in some ways, it read so much like the literature on the Muslim subject that I had been reading, you know, people like Tariq Ramadan, and the kind of discourse that my Muslim French interlocutors had. And I end that chapter by saying, you know, it's almost as if these Muslim French are in fact the only Republicans left in France. Because there's a sense now that, that, you know, authority and autonomy are opposed. And part of what I was getting at here, I mean, this isn't one of the other contradictions that I'm trying to trace. There's a kind of denial of the role of norms in the construction of the French subject citizen. And there's a way in which that relationship between, and that anxiety about the role that authority and authoritative normative authority plays in the construction of the autonomous subject, that anxiety in a lot of ways is displaced onto Muslims who are held to be the kind of non-autonomous selves who, you know, submit to authority. And when in fact the Republican citizen subject has long been understood as formed within a set of pretty constraining norms and a sets of authority. So that's what the fourth chapter is about in a lot of ways, and also about the way in which this Muslim French subjectivity and understanding of religious practice is largely unintelligible to the secular state, secular discourse, and also secular law.
So the third part of the book, Mayanthi, these last two chapters, you are looking at gender and sexuality in relationship to this notion of Muslim French. So what can you tell us about the specific role that ideas about gender difference and differences in terms of sexuality play in these discourses and then the responses of your interlocutors to the ways that French citizenship, Republican identity, secularism seem to exclude the possibility of being Muslim French?
Mm-hmm. Well, what interested me in those two final chapters, in chapter five, I was interested in the emergence of the so-called secular Muslim woman, la musulmane laïque. And in a lot of ways, I'm not tracing this, the kind of sociological demographic category, Le Musulman Laïc, but rather the trope of Le Musulman Laïc. So that chapter is not at all ethnographic. It's largely discourse media analysis. And mm-hmm. And what was really interesting to me is the way in which sex and gender norms have become really key to an understanding of what French secularity is all about. And there's a way in which part of my argument there is that the secular Muslim woman, the trope of the secular Muslim woman, plays a really key role in upholding the universality of secularism and republicanism by being the proper integrated Muslim subject. And there's a way in which, you know, full integration now hinges on a kind of conversion to secular republican French norms about sex and gender, you know, how one dresses, where the kind of romantic relationships one has, where one's integration is largely a matter of one's sort of sexual romantic gender practices. And that's what I was trying to get at in that fifth chapter. And the sixth chapter is about the discourse of, as I said, of Muslim homophobia. And again, it, in some ways, it's not a kind of, you know, ethnographic study of Muslim homophobia or Muslim attitudes towards gays and lesbians, but rather how the discourse of Muslim homophobia functions to occlude state practices of discrimination against both Muslims and gays and lesbians, the kind of heteronormativity of the state that gets again deferred onto Muslims, who become, you know, the kind of civilizational other through their supposed attitudes towards gays and lesbians.
In the epilogue to the book, Mayanthi, you follow up on this notion of tolerance, and it's in the title of the sixth chapter, Asymmetries of Tolerance. And you go on in the epilogue to discuss this idea of critical responsiveness and the possibilities of thinking in terms of critical responsiveness. So can you tell us what critical responsiveness means?
Sure.
And where or what the hope in it might be as a notion?
Sure. Critical responsiveness is a notion that I'm getting from the political philosopher William Connolly. And he's using critical responsiveness as a kind of as a way to get out of the liberal framework of tolerance and intolerance. And so he wants to try to see how different communities can possibly coexist, not by tolerating each other, but by having kind of agonistic conversations and interactions in which one is truly attuned to the other. And one might, and in being so attuned, one might actually change one's positions through what he calls critical responsiveness. And so, and I was trying to, that epilogue is an attempt to try to think about how coexistence is possible without necessarily, well, coexistence without assimilation, basically. So Connolly's argument relies on doubt. And he has this idea that basically communities can practice critical responsiveness including religious communities, because religion, is always, or one's religiosity is always anchored in some form of doubt. And I wanted to think about it slightly differently, because I would disagree. And I think that there are ways in which certainty about the truth of Islam or Christianity or whatever, what have you, can also be a point of critical responsiveness, precisely through the radical sovereignty of the divine and therefore the non-sovereignty of the human, right? And so there's a way, I think, in which critical responsiveness can be practiced through the knowledge that one never knows the truth. So it's not doubt that truth exists, but rather a certainty that truth exists and a certainty that the human can never actually approach that truth. And that I want to propose. And it's just a kind of, you know, it's like a 5-page epilogue, right? So it's just a proposal. But I wanted to propose that as one way of thinking about coexistence.
No, it's really interesting and provocative. And I was really struck by it, even though it's a short epilogue.
Yeah.
Really intrigued and wanted to ask you about it. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, I mean, I know that your interlocutors are probably primarily, well, not just French speakers, but maybe not all of them fluent English speakers. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about the ways in which you have either this book or other versions. I mean, I know you also write and speak in France and in French. Mm-hmm. How your interlocutors have responded to your readings and analyses following the work that you've done?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say most of my interlocutors don't speak English. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is have the book translated because I would really love to have them be able to read it.
Sure.
Most of their interaction with the book and with my arguments has largely come through talks that I've given in French, mm-hmm. in France. And, you know, I think the reception has generally been pretty good. I mean, it's one of those things too. I've kind of moved to a second project actually about sex and secularity and the way in which veiled women are constantly asked to sort of display in public and talk in public about their intimate lives, their intimate religious lives and their intimate sex lives in order to kind of prove mm-hmm. their secularity. And I have to say that talk, I mean, one of the most gratifying things, I've given that talk a number of times. And there's always a moment where, you know, someone in the audience says, "Oh my God, you've described my life," basically.
Wow. Right?
A woman in a headscarf is like, "This is my life." And there's something incredibly sad about that, right?
Sure.
But there's also something sort of gratifying in the sense that, you know, I feel like I am actually doing something valuable in theorizing the kind of daily difficulties that many of these people have to, you know, have to live. And so it is really important for me to not just speak to, you know, kind of Anglo-American, Anglophone audience. And I really have tried to, when I give talks in France, I always give them in French as much as possible, precisely so that the audience can really follow, right, and not mm-hmm. have to kind of struggle in English.
Well, you've already sort of taken us a little bit into the last question that I always ask authors, which is, what are you working on now? So you can you say a little bit more about this project on sex and secularity?
Sure. Well, it's about what I'm calling the cunning of secularism and the way in which secular power demands a certain accounting of the self, of the Muslim self, where in, you know, secular democracies, religion and sex are ostensibly private affairs. And that's one of the foundational axes of a kind of secular liberal society. But Muslim women are consistently compelled to reveal in public their private and intimate beliefs and practices of sex and of religion in order to prove themselves secular somehow. So you know, veiled Muslim women are constantly being asked, "Why do you wear the headscarf? Like, what, you know, what is this all about? Right? Tell us about your religion." And as I said before, since integration now largely hinges on sexual normativity, they're also asked about what they think, you know, about virginity tests and polygamy and all kinds of non-normative sexual practices. And they're supposed to prove their integration by condemning those practices. But it means that they're consistently compelled to talk in public about sex and religion, about their sexual beliefs and practices and their religious beliefs and practices. And there's a kind of, you know, what I mean, Foucauldian incitement to discourse mm-hmm. in some ways, right? That is happening. And what's particularly insidious is that when they do describe in public their beliefs and practices of sex and of religion, it turns out that they are not normative usually, right? I mean, the headscarf is understood not just as a religious aberration, but as a sexual aberration, as a form of sexual repression. So the very act of wearing the headscarf already disqualifies one as an integrated subject, both sexually and religiously. And so that's what I'm calling the cunning of secularism, where women are compelled to reveal in public their sexual and religious intimacies, but then in doing so are taken to task and are figured as not really secular, not really French, not really integrated.
Well, it sounds like a really important and exciting project, and I hope you'll come back and speak to me about it if when it comes out in your book more. Right. Mayanthi, I just want to thank you so much for joining me and for writing the book.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all of these terrific questions and giving me a chance to talk more about the book.